table for space stations. Doug?
Thank you, Dr. Von Braun. Developing and maintaining a continued and unexcelled capability to conduct manned operations in near-Earth space is one of the most fundamental objectives of our space program. A space station program itself offers an opportunity for this nation to exhibit its technical, its scientific, and its managerial prowess in a peaceful accomplishment which will contribute to rapid progress in science, technology, and the beneficial application of space to Earth's problems. We have now been actively engaged in manned Earth orbital activities for over 7 years. From the Mercury program, which first launched Americans into orbit, we learned that there was no inherent reason that man could not exist and work in space when he was given the proper protective systems that he needed. In the following Gemini program, we verified that man could remain in a weightless condition for up to 14 days without serious debilitation. Of equal significance to a space station thinking, however, is the fact that we are able to rendezvous and dock spacecraft, which is a necessary prelude to orbital assembly. This technique is essential to sustain space station operations. New crews, expendables, and experiments will be supplied to the station from the ground by periodic launches of a rendezvousing spacecraft. Although the orbital tests performed today with the Apollo systems have been aimed primarily at qualifying the equipment for the forthcoming lunar landing, some significant contributions have been made toward a space station design. The Apollo spacecraft, which contains nearly 6 times as much pressurized volume as the Gemini spacecraft, is the first vehicle large enough to allow the crew to freely move about for reasonable periods of time. We found that the crew rapidly learned that in space, moving about the spacecraft was much easier than it had been on the ground. I am sure the televised demonstrations of zero gravity from Apollo 7, 8, and 9, particularly the pictures of the camera and the pencil staying fixed or in motion without support, vividly showed the effects of this different environment. And certainly Walt Cunningham will have more to say about that later. The Apollo crew reported that they could restrain themselves with only minimal holds. We have concluded that crew motions in a zero-G environment will not require the extensive restraints or handholds originally thought necessary, and that the zero-G environment may facilitate rather than hinder motion. On the other hand, it has been proposed, as Dr. Von Braun mentioned, by several people and actively supported by many, that some level of artificial gravity may eventually be required in space, if not for physiological reasons, then for just convenience. The basic character of the space station program in NASA is that of a step-by-step growth. May I have the first chart, please? Each new step capitalizing upon the results of the prior steps. The first step is the AAP workshop and experiments, including the Apollo Telescope Mount, AAP standing for Apollo Applications Program. We should complete the first step in this program in 1971 and 1972. We are now initiating a program definition phase for the next step, that of a first space station having modular experiments and a regular logistics system. We hope to be able to achieve flight operations in this next step by the mid-70s, 75 or 76. Now, the next two phases don't have as distinct a time tag. They consist of an orbital buildup of a facility to support more men and perform more useful functions, such as the design that you saw shown by Dr. Von Braun. I would estimate the buildup phase to this more advanced base phase would be completed by the early 1980s, and at that time we would have a true orbital laboratory capability. Now, let me describe to you in a little more detail something about these three steps. These many steps, rather. In the Apollo Applications Program, we will explore crew operations within a larger free volume. May I have the next chart, please? This chart shows the Saturn I workshop, which consists of the expended upper stage of the Saturn IB vehicle. It is shown in the launch configuration here. On top of the S4B stage is the airlock and multiple docking adapter to which additional configurations can be docked. It would be launched like this, operated in this configuration in its final ultimate buildup, which I will show a better picture of later. The S-4B stage will have been modified on the ground to accommodate crew facilities for 3 men. Understand that not all of the equipment is in this area at launch. Most of it is up in the docking adapter and airlock, and is then carried down into the hydrogen tank after it has been after the fuel has been expended. After the orbit is obtained, the residual hydrogen and oxygen will be vented to space, and this stage is stabilized. We have the next chart. At this time, we have a second Saturn IB launch carrying a typical Apollo command and service module modified to carry up additional expendables for this workshop. This command and service module then supplies the atmosphere of oxygen and nitrogen to the empty hydrogen tank. The crew will then proceed from the command module through the docking adapter and the airlock into the hydrogen tank. Solar panels out here will provide approximately 11 kilowatts of electrical power. The crew will then install the portable quarters, the food preparation and eating facilities, and experimental equipment within the tank. They will remain in this spent stage workshop for a period of 28 days, conducting medical, scientific, and technological experiments. At the end of this period, the crew will re-enter the Apollo command module and return to Earth. Later in 1971, a second command module and crew will rendezvous and dock with the dormant laboratory, and this time spend 56 days in the facility conducting follow-on experiments. Next chart, please. Early in 1972, a third command and service module will come up and rendezvous and dock with the laboratory. This operation will be followed by a separate launch of an Apollo telescope mount, which uses a typical upper stage of the lunar module, which is being used in the Apollo lunar landing, and has the Apollo telescope mounted on the lower end of it. This experiment package has its own solar cell array capable of supplying about 5 kilowatts. A 56-day program of multispectral solar observations will be conducted. The astronauts will directly participate in controlling the telescopes, searching for and selecting interesting solar phenomena for detailed observations, and retrieving and replenishing film from the solar telescopes. The base of knowledge we have gained from our space activities allows us now to start planning a series of Earth orbital space activities a step beyond this workshop. Although you understand this is as far as our approved program goes at this time. The space station program itself will introduce a new, more mature and routine mode of space operations. Man will live and work in space for long periods of time. A large scale of operations will develop, perhaps with a single large orbital facility, or perhaps with several smaller facilities in the orbits required to meet specific uses. Men will be ferried between these stations and ground in reusable land-landing spacecraft. The station will be used by multiple agencies of the government and by industry to satisfy a broad spectrum of space uses. The orbital stations will become more autonomous, both in terms of command and control and in terms of life support commodities. All of these factors will tend to lower the cost of space operations and a resultant increase in use of this major resource. The first stage of this program, may I have the next chart, please, is depicted in this slide, where we show a typical early station which could be launched in the mid-70s. The basic elements of the station are modular. You will see here there are 4 primary areas of this one, plus a docking section here, large solar panels for power, and this particular section out here is a laboratory, and this one actually shows a hangar in which an automated spacecraft could be brought in for periodic maintenance or repair. This down in the corner indicates a free-flying telescope module which could also come in for periodic maintenance. And the reusable type shuttle, such as Dr. Von Braun talked about, is shown here for resupply. In a station like this, an Earth-like atmosphere of oxygen and nitrogen will be supplied with a total pressure perhaps of about 10 psi, but with near sea level partial pressure of oxygen. We are planning to provide adequate electrical power for both housekeeping and experimental uses. In this case, articulate solar rays are depicted, which would supply approximately 20 kilowatts now of electrical power. The core module will normally operate, in this case, in a zero gravity mode, but we would probably plan to conduct an initial assessment of the usefulness of artificial gravity with this module. The module would be counterbalanced in that case with a spent stage which was used to launch it, and the total system spun up to in the order of 3 tenths to 7 tenths gravity. May I have the next chart, please? We are planning to allow for future growth of this core station into a much larger space base, one concept for which is shown here. This one indicates a system which could handle approximately 50 men. The three largest elements out on the ends would be similar to the first module that I showed on the previous chart. The interdigitated modules are 30 kilowatt reactor systems, so that we would have a total capacity on board here then of 90 kilowatts. Non-astronaut scientists would now be included in the crew as a regular thing. This space station concept would provide two environments now. An artificial gravity environment in the crew living modules out at the ends of the large wings, and a zero-gravity counter-rotating section in the central hub. Adequate shielding, of course, would have to be provided to protect the crew and sensitive experiments from the reactors. The change in mission duration from the 2 weeks of Apollo or Gemini to the nominal 6 months tour being considered for stations such as this, coupled with the change in nature and training of the crew from astronauts who are by choice and training primarily test pilots to scientists with much different interests and backgrounds, requires the introduction of a new concept and design of space station interiors. I know those of you who have had the opportunity to sit in the Gemini or Apollo spacecraft will agree that to spend 2 weeks in so small a volume requires a Spartan level of dedication and motivation. To aid us in designing the space station interiors to meet the new requirements posed by very long missions, we have contracted the services of the industrial designing firm of Loewy Snaith. This afternoon, I'd like to show you some of their concepts they have proposed, which are not firm or final by any means, for the habitability areas of such a long-duration space station as we are considering today. Next chart, please. This slide indicates a cutaway of a quadrant of an illustrative space station. The upper deck contains station operations and control areas, the second deck a wardroom-type arrangement, recreation and exercise areas, and the third deck sleeping compartment arrangements. A tunnel, which serves as a safety refuge, runs through the center of all compartments. These sketches happen to be made presuming presence of an artificial gravity field, such as I proposed on the previous slide. This may be the mode in which space research facilities' habitability areas will operate on a long-term basis. However, as I mentioned, some portions of the central laboratory hub will certainly be at zero gravity, since most of our pointing or zero-G experiments do require that kind of environment. The next slide shows a compartment which has been designed by Loewy Snaith, sized for two men. One bunk is in a stowed position above the other. The crewman has a place to read or write and to work on data from experiments over here on the side. Warm, bright colors have been used to reduce the feeling of crampedness or confinement. This room has a volume of about 420 cubic feet and a floor space of 60 square feet, about one quarter the size of a motel room, so it is not overly spacious. In designing this particular habitat, I would like to say that there have been some considerations made to the design of a compartment which could operate either in zero G or artificial G. You notice toe holds, hip restraints here, and other things which indicate there has been some preliminary consideration of this dual mode operation. The next slide shows an even more compact crew quarters. In this case, dual use is obtained from the area occupied by a desk by locating a fold-up bed directly above the desk. A member of my staff suggested we adopt this arrangement for our office. He pointed out it would be very useful after some of our late-night planning sessions. I'd like to point out that the centerfold of Playboy has already been provided. Another highly significant factor in crew contentment is dining in terms of the types of food and the dining areas. On every spaceflight we have made to date, the crew has commented on the food and its preparation facilities. Comments have not always been favorable. In this concept, we are taking... Yeah, the next chart, please. We are taking a lesson from the Navy and providing a functional but pleasant dining area. In this arrangement, food is served in a dumbwaiter from above. The crew members face one another. They may not want to do this after some time, but the idea is to encourage conversations. A minimal station status monitoring capability would be provided, even in this compartment, to alert the crew should an unsafe condition develop. My final slide is a very preliminary sketch of a station control area. The initial response to this illustration has been that it looks like an electrical power station control room or a submarine control room instead of a spacecraft. This reaction is probably a good one, since the functions performed in this compartment are very similar to those performed in any process control center. We have concluded that necessarily some difference will exist from ground operations, Since manpower in space is very expensive, we will automate to the maximum practical extent to free the crew for more useful tasks. We also know we'll have to design for ease of access to equipment for repair and troubleshooting. Hence, the racks shown are designed to pull forward for back access and to allow inspection and repair of the spacecraft walls should a meteoroid puncture occur. We are also starting conceptual work on what the general purpose laboratory area should look like. This poses more problems than the habitability areas because we really don't have good guidelines for designing a laboratory for multi-purpose use on the ground. For this reason, we plan to design a laboratory as best we can with present knowledge, but make it physically flexible so that we may change it as we learn how to conduct experiments in space. One method of providing this flexibility will be through the use of separately launched experiment modules which can dock to the station for periodic maintenance or repair and be operated in either an attached or a free-flying mode. May I have the lights on, please? In summary, it is readily apparent that the timetable for manned space stations is less than crystal clear. We are, however, taking the first conceptual steps in thinking about these systems. To design a hotel, a factory, and a scientific laboratory on Earth requires the skills of engineers, scientists, industrial designers, and architects. We find that the same skills are needed to design for space. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lord. Our next panelist, R. Walter Cunningham, is probably best known as one of the stars of the famous television program, which had a brief run last fall in what they called the lovely Apollo 7 room, high atop everything. Co-starring with Walter Cunningham, that show where Wally Schirra and Don Eisler. One of the 14 astronauts selected by NASA in October 1963, Mr. Cunningham has a master's degree in physics from the University of California at Los Angeles. He was also a flyer and a major in the Marine Corps. Before his selection as an astronaut, he worked as a research scientist with the RAND Corporation. He will give us some insights from his experience on living and working in space. Well,
thank you very much, Dr. Von Braun. When I was told the subject was going to be living and working in space, I wasn't sure how appropriate that would be to my experience. Living, yes, we did live in space, but we didn't really work. If you noticed, we had a lot of fun. We enjoyed it a lot. I think it's pretty important to make a distinction, as a matter of fact, between existing in space and living in space. As far as I'm concerned, the primary, most significant accomplishment of the Gemini program was the flight of Gemini 7. In that particular flight, Frank Borman and Jim Lovell existed for 14 days. Now, I couldn't feel any stronger about it, in that really took an awful lot of fortitude. When we got to the Apollo spacecraft, we started a new generation of vehicles in which you could get up and move around. That makes a world of difference. We went from 75 cubic feet of volume in there to 225 cubic feet. We had a chance to start living in space. When it comes to working, we have to recognize there's an awful lot of work that has to be done of a necessity, continuously, in a vehicle like this. In many cases, you'll find out that the energy exerted for that work is a lot less than you might expect down here. In still other instances, it turns out to be an awful lot more work. I'm thinking of particularly the difference between IVA and EVA. And I'll go into that a little bit more thoroughly following on here. We enjoyed ourselves. We had a very good time. I guess that's a subjective reaction, too. I asked Rusty Schweikert the day after he got back. He was in the office, and I was. I asked him, did you have a good time? And he says, well, after about the seventh or eighth day, when I could move around nicely, he did. The point there being is there is going to be some kind of a subjective reaction to zero G, and we may be looking at one extreme to the other from what we've seen so far. And when Rusty adjusted to it, as we all know he did have some problems there, is he thoroughly enjoyed the exposure to zero G. I am belaboring this point slightly, maybe to bring up the fact that I think we ought to be taking advantage of this zero-G exposure. In a way, I was kind of glad to see Rusty get a little sick up there. It made them forget about the flight of Apollo 7. We were famous for taking part in the test of an 11-day coal capsule. I was also told before I came up here that you people were interested in electronics and that I might dwell a little bit on the kind of failures we may have. Actually, everything works pretty well, with the exception of electronics once in a while. But when they do act up, they don't turn green around the gills and we don't have a mess in the spacecraft. I'm really not going to say very much about the electronics. I would like to get on to the man-spacecraft interface. I might stress that the single most important thing that we should still be working with in electronics is the reliability. It's significant that even now we've got 3 Apollo flights under our belt and we still have problems with relays and switches that we're trying to change out from time to time. Not that these even have shown up as failures in flight, but the fact that testing shows up that particular switches, for example, may have solder balls floating around in it. And this necessitates a requirement to change these out as rapidly as you can get at them. I think it reflects the continuing conservative approach of the administrators and the people that are running the manned space program, is that there's not going to take a single solitary chance if they can possibly avoid it. I think it's a good, sensible approach to be taking. I think that what I ought to spend the remaining time here before we finish up and get down to questions is talking to you really about what you do in zero-G. I think that I'd start off here by showing you a film of the IVA on Apollo 7. I've just pulled out the best parts of the IVA. I'll narrate it for you and try to point out a few significant things that you may notice. Before we do run it, I think the general thing to keep in mind is watch it for ease of operation. See where you couldn't take advantage of how easily everybody gets around and things can be accomplished. We're talking about IVA now. That's intervehicular activity as opposed to the extravehicular activity, and there's a significant difference. If you notice how slow you move and how little force it takes to change your direction, you'll realize that you don't have to worry a lot about such things as clearances. Getting through doors, for example, if something can just barely fit, and I'm not advocating we go to that tight of clearances, if something just barely fits, you go with such slow motion there that it just you can move it right on through. Why don't we go ahead and run the film here, and I'll narrate it, and then we'll get down to some actual cases. You'll notice that the subjects appear sideways sometimes and sometimes upside down. Now, that wasn't planned that way, but it should bring home to you the fact that how natural it was. Thinking back on it, we would have had to make a special effort to always have these films looking right side up to you people. I took this particular shot, for example, and I'm over here in my couch, and the relationship is exactly the one that I have right now to Don. He seems to be sideways there to you. It makes no difference to him. He's thoroughly adjusted. He was putting some of the pieces of equipment up there. In this case, that's a wet wipe after you finish with a meal for cleaning it up. This is Wally using the exerciser. We used an Exergenie-type exerciser in here, and we did it in just this fashion, as a matter of fact. Wally's now talking to the ground about something on the checklist. And the way we did it is we'd set up the exerciser, and one man may have it for 30 to 45 minutes there, continuing to run the store, so to speak, and yet accomplishing what he wanted to with exercise. Wally has his lap belt fastened here. Well, in this case, he doesn't. But normally we'd fasten the lap belt here just to keep from moving you around. Now, as long as he's got his feet in that, you see he's reacting only against himself. Whenever he bumps up against something, he moves away. It's significant that with those switches, during 11 days of flight, we did not once throw a switch accidentally. The forces required to throw the switches are greater than what it takes to move you away from that particular switch. I'm in the midst of a meal here, and Wally's doing some photographing. That's the lens cover. (Clears throat) You know, it does look funny here, and there was a certain amount of hilarity associated with this. But there's a story behind this also. We were in about the fourth day before we started taking any of these films. The reason being, they were on board to document problem areas with IVA. By about the fourth day, we hadn't had any problem areas to document. And we decided that, well, we ought to, you know, take something here to at least show that we had no problems. And we started off by taking what we called home movies. We figured at the very least, we'd want to save these to show our kids sometime. This is a preparation of a meal. I've got a reconstitutable food bag out, and that's a scissors that we use to cut off the opening so that you could insert the water pistol in to fill it up, and at the other end you would open up the spout to eat with. Now, if you notice my knees there, I've got them pressed slightly against the instrument panel. In essence, I operated without a seatbelt throughout the entire mission. That's a water pistol. You notice we stuck it back in a switch wicket, and that's where we left it most of the time. Never any problem of throwing switches accidentally again. And I think we have a very good solution with the wickets that we have there. Okay, this is to show you the behavior of bubbles in zero-G. They're just floating around all by themselves. We do an exercise here where we spin this around just to get the bubbles to conglomerate in the center, or agglomerate into one large bubble. And we're holding up that in front of a light. That is coffee. That's Wally's coffee, as a matter of fact. Wally and Don took instant coffee along. Now, you see that bubble? It's all back together there in the center. Now, this is exactly how easy and slow you could move around in that vehicle. If I was the Russians, I'd be worried after looking at these shots. Problem here is that we've got a wide-angle lens, and it makes it look like we've got a ballroom up there to move around in. And it's really just a little over 6 feet, shoulder to shoulder across there. I'm by Don, who's just getting up, and you notice that's a tight spot. You can't do that in 1G right there where we went by. You can't fit through there. But we floated right through and didn't even hardly bother Don, who's getting dressed. Okay, I'm over in my couch. Here's Don putting on his jacket. He looks kind of scroungy. He must be about the sixth or seventh day up there. He's got to hook up his communications. Incidentally, those umbilicals, even the comm umbilical, is enough to exert force on you and affect your behavior. And here's Wally. Wonder who's taking the picture here. See, our space program's completely open and above board almost. I can guarantee you we weren't working on that unskilled labor problem you brought up. Now, Don takes out, right now he's going over to a temporary stowage bag there. I don't know if he's getting something out or putting it in. But you'll notice when we do a lot of these things, we set what we're working with out in front of you. It's hard to let go with no force at all, so there's a tendency for it to drift around, but it's very easy to set something right in front of you there and turn around and do something, come back and pick it up. It's just floating right there. This was to show you, I took this picture incidentally, to show that Don was not using the foot restraints. There's some Velcro down there, and he had Velcro slippers that he could have stuck to them. And I didn't even put my Velcro slippers on for the first couple days, and made me realize that I was doing nav sightings and I wasn't utilizing the restraint. And Don didn't put his slippers on the last couple days for some reason. This is Wally doing his favorite thing. He's going to bed underneath his couch. The real thing here is that it was always amazing to him that he'd come up like this. You just one pull. And he's coming. Now, you've got to appreciate there's little or no force being exerted at any place. Here's a typical problem, too, you notice. He's obviously not oriented correctly because he ends up over in my couch instead of his. It's because you're used to seeing things in this particular vehicle one way, and when you come up, you're turned around, and you end up the other way. Being an old gymnast, I wanted to try this. We're back to some more food preparation. I didn't attempt to put this in any particular order. It's just the films as we took them. I clipped out some of the darker sections, but other than that, it's as we took them on board. One of the problems is getting enough light. We could only take these pictures if the spacecraft was drifting into an attitude where we had enough sunlight coming in the window. Now, you watch the bubble in the center there. It's hard to see because we've got too much light, but it all comes together. We were attempting to show how the bubbles would do. In all these pictures, you can look around the spacecraft and see what you do in the real world for... Now, there's a large bubble. He's tempted to move it very carefully so it doesn't fly apart. You can look around and see how we utilize the various nooks and crannies to actually put things up. This is a sequence that Wally never wants to leave out of the film. We were doing a suiting exercise at 6 frames per second, but it's being shown back now at about 16 frames a second. Wally likes to run it backwards. Maybe we have that on here. When it's running backwards, it looks like you're in a hurry and saying, "Where's the John?" I guess that's the end of the film. At any rate, I use that film primarily just to put in perspective what I'm going to say about working in a space station. And I'm thinking in particular the Apollo applications, the so-called wet workshop. The wet workshop is an S-4B. If I can get the slide back on now of the second slide that Doug Lord had up here. Now, this is a slide of the Saturn, the S-4B stage, after it's been deactivated in orbit and it's already been set up as a crew quarters. Now, you can take a look and see that we've got a very large tank. The thing to keep in mind with the working in an orbital workshop like this is that the command module had 225 cubic feet of volume that was then encroached upon with various other hardware and spacecraft. This particular vehicle you're looking at there, we've got 11,000 cubic feet of free volume. It's 22 feet across, about 21 feet across, inside, side to side. The fireman's pole that you have the man going up from the hatch down below on, it's almost 6 feet from that pole to the nearest side. So you see, he's in a position where he's not close to grab a hold of a lot of handholds like we had in the command module. That's the primary difference. However, if you extrapolate through neutral buoyancy tests and what you'd know about zero-G in a command module, and now the LEM also, it's pretty easy to make good generalizations about what you can do in that workshop. In the upper story up there, we've got a situation where we've got a floor that's been established as a floor. And while it doesn't make any difference which way it's oriented, it seems to be a sensible way of referring to it. It's got a grid work pattern. It's set up to be easy to grab a hold of and move around, or also to use restraint systems. There's also a ceiling. It's 6'6" between floor and ceiling, and that brings up one of my criticisms of a situation like this, is that was established around having a distance separating the floor and the ceiling where you could use a technique called compression walking. Now, that's a torture mechanism devised by 1G people to force somebody in 0G not to take advantage of 0G. It means you put your hand on the ceiling and your feet on the floor and you force yourself to walk around in a, quote, upright position. Inside of that vehicle, I don't have the least bit hesitancy in telling you that people are going to be moving around like we moved around in the command module. If anything, it looks like a fish in water or a scuba diver moving around. The crew quarters are set up with doors as we know them. It resembles somewhat a ship's compartment. I think those doors, they're also of a dimension to allow you to move through, translate through in a, quote, upright position. And you'll probably be going through most of those head first. There's a sleep station there that's going to have, the one that says crew quarters on, it's probably going to have two astronauts sleeping in. There's one on the far side, another crew quarter, that's going to have a third astronaut. You got a waste compartment there, which is set up to centralize all the waste management tasks, and a food preparation compartment, which some people have envisioned much like a ward room. I think most of these things are probably constrained a little bit too much by a person's 1G thinking down here. I think that if we really get down to it, we'll try to take more advantage of zero-G. If you've noticed, there's been a great effort to talk about on applications. Dr. von Braun mentioned ball bearings and the like. You've tried to take advantage of what zero-G has to offer. I think the biggest thing we can do with living is try to do the same thing. Take a look at what zero-G has to offer and try to use it. Same way, anything other special about that environment. For example, there's a vacuum out there that's been relatively untapped. We talk from time to time about using the vacuum to run things. It's an ideal source of operation for various pieces of equipment. I've seen very few really good pieces of equipment designed to operate on that vacuum. I think we ought to be taking more advantage of that. This workshop is going to be the first attempt that we're going to make at really living in a large volume. I could have thrown up the slide there, I guess, of Dr. von Braun's the Marshall unit to show you how easy they're going to break us in. We refer to that as a Saturn V with training wheels. If we can go on to the next Doug Lord's next slide, it brings up another aspect of working in space. Well, I think it's the one after this then, the one that's got the LEM ATM on. While he's doing that, I might mention that that workshop, after you set it up, and it should be fully set up inside of about 6 days, I believe, in the orbit operations of that first Apollo applications mission, then they'll be performing engineering and medical experiments. I think that we're seeing a very, very firm and necessary requirement to look into the medical aspects of extending man's duration in flight. I think we've shown that man can do very well up to 14 days. There's two questions still to be asked. How long can he go in zero-G? And you can't answer that without also bringing him back, because you have to find out, can he readjust, his body systems readjust well enough to take the reentry? We know of no way to get the reentry forces down significantly in the next in the near term aspects. The more we can get a lifting body out of there, the better off we can do with, in that respect. However, we still have to face up that man has to come back down here into a 1G environment, and therefore we have to approach this cautiously. I think the general medical term is talking about this in terms of doubling. For example, the first mission on AAP is 28 days. That doubles the time we had in the past. You bring him back, see how he went through the reentry and what's his physical condition afterwards. The next flight will be right on up there for 56 days. I think that we're already in the era where we have to have a doctor on board for several reasons. One, the medical experiments that are being run are probably complex enough where it pays to have a specialized individual on board to handle it. And secondly, you're getting a long enough duration up there where it'd probably be nice to have a physician to handle routine medical problems that might come up. When we talk about working in space, we can't neglect the fact that the biggest amount of work we've shown so far in space has to do with EVA. I show this vehicle here because this is launched on, right now, presently planned, the third manned flight of this orbiting laboratory, which, incidentally, I don't know if Doug Lord mentioned, it's going to have a lifetime of 8 months. The LEM ATM is built by our good friends from Grumman out here on Long Island. The ascent stage is the control center to operate five telescopes. They've got five telescopes that are sitting down there in the ATM portion. It's got the solar panels coming off the bottom. And those five experiments will cover the electromagnetic spectrum range from, I believe, it's someplace around 5 angstroms up to about 2,000 angstroms with a gap then, and an experiment in the visual range on up higher. Now, the significant thing about all those experiments, as far as working in space goes, is that they have to have the film returned in order to bring back the data from these experiments. In order to return those films, you have to go out and unload the cameras, or in many cases, they're exchanging the cameras themselves. If you look at the LEM here, this is what we call there's the hatch. When you come out of it, you stand on what's called the front porch, right down in this area. Around behind, which is not showing, is a workstation that we call at the LEM end, and in that we can change the film packs in three of these experiments. In order to do the rest of it, you got to come down here to the sun end. That's about 20 feet across there, if I remember right. Last week we were busy in the neutral buoyancy tank at Marshall Space Flight Center evaluating just this kind of a task. And it turns out that it's still a lot of work. It was my first exposure to prolonged evaluation of a technique in neutral buoyancy. I would like to say right here that if you can do it in neutral buoyancy, you can sure do it in zero-G. The message I have there is that zero-G is, if anything, easier because it's more perfect. We've got to put up with certain shortcomings with this neutral buoyancy operation. However, that was the only way we could ever move into getting realistic estimates on timelines. You've got a KC-135 for evaluating some of these things, and you can get up to 25 seconds of zero G. That just is not enough, even if you stop operations, start it up again, and try to keep track of the elapsed time. In the neutral buoyancy, while it has some shortcomings, it's the only place where you can take a look at an operation that's going to run you an hour or 2 hours and get any feel at all for just how it's going to go. The tank at Marshall is a rather impressive thing. It's like a large swimming pool that's 50 feet deep. In it, they have all of that hardware there except the command service module itself in one form or another. They've had to cut a couple pieces apart and put it in there in two. But at any rate, the important point here is that EVA is still going to be a lot of work, and we should try to make it as easy as we can. The single best way to improve it is to make the suits better. Now, in making it better, we've got to be very careful that we don't make it more complicated and harder. There is a certain school of thought that ends up developing complicated equipment. Well, not complicated equipment. Let's just say equipment to do the job. And I think in particular of transporters and various fancy ways to get a job done. Now, it turns out that in many cases that the energy expended in utilizing the mechanized hardware there is equal to or even greater than that you would expend just taking yourself down to where you want to go. I think we've got to be very careful that in trying to be helpful to a man out there, we don't make him work harder than he already has to. So far we've talked nothing but zero G here. I think we ought to recognize that while it hasn't demonstrated it yet, there's every possibility that prolonged exposure to zero G can lead to a requirement for low G space stations. You've had several people up here talk to you about those already today. I won't go into it, except to encourage you as engineers that if you're working on low G space stations, don't overlook the fact that you also, when you go into a low G space station, you're opening up a Pandora's box of new problems, possibly. You've got to keep in mind that while you're trying to solve one thing, you may be opening a door to another one, and those you're going to have to start closing up gaps in a different area than you used to in the past. And I'd like to encourage you to do very, very critical thinking about the type of things you do propose. We can expect to have a whole new world of engineering problems, engineering solutions, and developments coming from you people when you go to low G. We've also seen some pictures up here of various ways of making the space station habitable. The only thing I can say so far about those people, Doug, is they watch the same program I do. It looks like it's straight out of Star Trek. And I don't know how Star Trek has licked their problems, but I feel like we've got to be very careful that we don't fall into thinking that by making something easier to look at or better to live with, that we've accomplished making it easier to use or helped man's habitability in that environment any better. I think everything is going to have to come, first off, it's going to have to be usable and operationally feasible, and it should always help his position up there. It should never become a handicap, you know, just in order to utilize it. I think that finally I'd like to sum up, we can turn that off if you will. I'd like to sum up by saying that so far are looking in the very near future, 1971 isn't that far away, we're looking at man being exposed to space station type operations for up to 56 days at least. And I've been asked many times in the past, how long do you think man can go in space? I don't know how long man can go in space, but we don't have any real reason to know that there's any end to his exposure. I mean, the end that's going to be making him a medical requirement not to be up there. I think that's one of the things we're trying to find out. I think we have certain adaptive processes going on in the human body that the doctors seem to think may stabilize out after a period of like 6 months. I think the doctors are willing to say that if you can show that man can go up to 6 months with no ill effects, there may be no limit to how long he can be exposed. I think we're looking ahead to the next 10 years of very interesting living and working in space. Thank you.